Accession number 30419, reel 9.
There was another ground school. You had to learn a little about piston engines, because at Cranwell we learned mostly about jet engines. And I was at a great disadvantage because I didn't have a car. The instructor was always saying, well, of course, in your cars you will know about conrods. And I didn't know a thing about conrods and crankshafts and mixture control. So I then bought a car. I bought a Morris 8 for 40 quid off a Jordanian officer and learnt to drive it. And I was lucky. McCarthy actually needed a lift to London a couple of times. So I gave him a lift in my Morris 8, and he says he still remembers my cornering and roundabout techniques. And a guy called Robin Kane taught me reversing in the turn, because I got I phoned up the test centre and said I was being posted. Did they have any cancellations? They said, turn up tomorrow. And Robin Kane took me for a crash course in reversing on the airfield. And I went down to the test centre. And Cambridge is very flat, so there wasn't anywhere to do a hill start, which is just as well. I stalled the thing twice. I tried to go up into fourth gear. There's only three gears on the Morris 8. But I was wearing full uniform and with wings, and I think that may have helped, and I passed first go. That was another wonderful moment, learning, having a driving license. But then it started, and we were doing fine. We were on this course. Came Christmas. I drove to Bristol in my Morris 8, took my brother and his new wife, and back again. And as we left Bristol on Boxing Day, 1962, it started to snow. And it stopped snowing in March 1963. It was the most horrendously cold winter. And it, of course, it caused a lot of disruption to the flying. Oakington, about 6 inches of snow dropped. And when we got back there, we found that the station commander had, and I don't blame him, tried to clear the runway with vampire jets. There were vampires there as well. It had failed. He didn't have any snow blowers. He had vampire jets. All they had done was melted the snow, so we had 3 inches of ice. We spent 2 weeks, I think, chipping the ice off the runway with picks and shovels. We got half the runway cleared, and we could just get the varsities off, and we flew into another station, Witten, which had snow blowers, and continued there. But the course was significantly delayed. It was a nice course.
You take me through it from the beginning? Because I don't know.
Yeah.
I get an overview of what the differences are.
Yes. The varsity is the development of the Valletta, which itself was a very military version of the Viking, all made by Vickers Armstrong, and with two piston engines, Bristol Hercules, quite powerful engines. The Valletta we'd done our navigation training on, and it was an old pig. The Varsity was really quite an advanced aeroplane, much more powerful engines.
Can you give me a thumbnail sketch? What were its good points and bad points?
It had a tricycle undercarriage, a nose wheel, which made landing more straightforward. It had powerful engines. It had a nice big cockpit with room in it. It had some navigation aids, radio compasses, and it had a standard blind flying panel. It was a passenger airplane, so it had room for a couple of dozen passengers or paratroops or freight. But the Varsity was a training version of it. The one we had was the training version. It had no untoward nasty characteristics. It stalled pretty straightforwardly, and it flew quite high if you wanted to, but we didn't. I don't think we ever got very high. It would go about 15,000 feet, but we never went up there. We used to. I can remember the lasting memory I have is of sitting in the on a solo cross country. Two of you went, and you took it in turns basically, and we sat there with our packed lunches and flasks of coffee with the autopilot on. It had an autopilot, flying across the wash, looking at the sights, eating our sandwiches, lovely, and. I can remember having difficulty with understanding the relationship between RPM and boost, and I still don't quite understand it. You had superchargers on the engines which boosted the engine, so you could increase the pressure of the fuel going into the cylinders, which gave it a lot more power. But if you got all this extra power, you had to change the RPM and the pitch settings, and I could never work that out. And I never had to, because as soon as we got to Witten, just about, three of us were pulled off the course to be posted to 215 Argosy Squadron, which was being formed in a rush to go and reinforce the transport resource in the Far East, because trouble was brewing up in the Far East with Indonesia, and the army was going to need many more airplanes for air supply. And so I didn't finish the course at Oakington, and neither did the other two, and we were sent down to, I think we did about two-thirds of the course.
You never got to fly Shackleton's.
And I never got to fly Shackleton's.
if we can just sort of say hello for a minute, and I can just check.
Mary had a little lamb, its fleece was white as snow.
That looks pretty good to me. Okay, so we were going to go backwards briefly and just talk about night flying at Cranwell.
Yes. One of the most exciting and interesting and enjoyable experiences at Cranwell was night flying. I've never done any of it before, of course, and I also hadn't driven a car, and a lot of us hadn't driven a car. So to be sat in an aeroplane going at night along a taxi track with taxiway with lights. Red lights one side, blue on the other. I can't remember which side was which, but as long as you kept one of the colours on the left-hand side, you were going the right way. That was the way it worked. It was wonderful. And you did it in good weather, so you had starlit skies, and so the whole setting was evocative, and you'd driven there from the college in the evening in the bus, because we were at Barston Heath still, and so you were going out, and you were going night flying, and there was a real buzz and frisson. I can remember that very well. Good boy's own stuff. And it's different, night flying, so you had quite a briefing about it, about what to expect. You have to use the instruments, of course, because there isn't an horizon. In those days, there weren't so many lights on the ground. The built-up areas in Lincolnshire were few and far between, so you had to use the instruments from takeoff, and takeoff again, you were into the unknown because it was dark, and the lights in the cockpit were all these subdued blues so they didn't affect your night vision, and they were all exciting, and off you went into the sky, and of course that was something else again, with the stars above, and this was quite disconcerting, because in Lincolnshire without so much on the ground, there were more lights in the sky than there were on the ground, which is the wrong way round. These days, you fly over London, you don't see the stars, it's just so bright. And you would cruise around, go around the circuit. You'd leave the circuit as well and go to a landmark. And when you got used to it, you would then do a night cross country. But imagine setting off into the dark to go and find Mablethorpe, say, on the east coast of Lincolnshire. And that was fascinating navigation. The whole thing was wonderful. And we came back, then you come back to the circuit and practice the landings. And the landings at night, you've got, of course, the lights on the runway, they're lit up. And I used to find the way to judge the height was to imagine that you were letting yourself down into the bath. So the lights on the edge were the edge of the bath, and you let yourself down in the bath, and boop, you're on the runway. Wonderful. Then taxi back with all the lights again, and real adrenaline rush, and everybody had this. And so going back to college, I suppose about 10 o'clock in the bus, lots of chattering and comparing of notes. And then the greatest thing of all, a fried meal in the mess after everybody else had finished. So you had got that thing as well. It was a wonderful occasion. And this was carried on at Oakington. And there we did solo note flying in those varsities, and it was the same again, navigation by the lights on the ground, if there were any, but looking for the built-up areas. I remember having one difficulty on a night cross-country. On my chart, there was nothing indicated, but in front of me was a sizeable town with flames and all kinds of things, and it wasn't on my chart. It was Corby, which was a new steel town, and when the chart was printed, it wasn't there. And when I was doing my night flying, it was, and you had to watch out for that sort of thing. At Oakington, yes, again, we used to set off with our coffee and sandwiches at night and trundle along in the varsities. And we got to Thorny Island, which is where the four or five of us went for the Operation Conversion Unit, OCU, onto the Argus's.
Can we just, let's just get times again, so which we're...
This is the spring of 1963.
Okay.
So we left Cranwell in 62, September, advanced flying training through the winter of 62-63, when there was deep snow and ice until Easter, and therefore those of us who were sent to the Argosy OCU didn't finish the course, because we were going to make up the crews on a newly reformed squadron, 215 squadron. 215 squadron had a fairly checkered history. I think it was a night fighter squadron in the First World War, and its motto was Adeste Nox Adest, which is Arise, Night is at Hand. It had then become a bomber squadron in Northwest Frontier, and it was reformed to become this transport squadron in Singapore, because there was a reinforcement or increasing of the forces in Singapore as trouble was brewing with Indonesia. This would have been the spring of 63.
Did you have much sense of the squadron's history when you were... Did you have much sense of what of the personalities? Or
Not very much at the OCU. At the OCU, we were... quite a lot of us lumped in together by the time we all got there. There were the Hastings and the Beverleys had their OCU at at Thorny Island, and those guys were destined to go out to Singapore and to Borneo. I'm not absolutely certain, Cathy, whether we knew when we went to Thorny Island we were joining 215. It may have come apparent as we went through. But I actually wasn't aware of the squadron history until I came to write a book about it 40 years later. We were young and squadron history, history and all that punk. Hadn't got time for that. There were things to do, like learning to fly these big silver transports. Thorny Island is one of the lovely places in the world.
Whereabouts is it? I don't know where it is.
It's on the south coast between Hayling Island and Chichester. And it is an island. It's more a peninsula, but it's such a narrow neck of land between it and the mainland that it's called an island. But there's nothing on it. There was nothing on it but the OCU, a farm. I think there was a farm and a little church. Some of my colleagues got married there, and the camp. Runway going straight out to sea, and just across the sea was the Isle of Wight. So, and we were there in the summer. 63, did I say? Yes, that's right. Not 64, 63 we were there. And it was a wonderful summer. We were playing the West Indians at cricket, I can remember, and the sun came down all the time. The sun was beating down on those. And we were learning to fly these things. Before we went there, we had to go on a factory course.
What did that involve?
That involved driving in my Morris 8 up the M1, the newly opened M1, with the snow piled up around us. So this must have been before Easter. And I broke down on the M1, which was terrifying at night. I parked in a service station, and when I came to restart the car, it was the only service station in England. It was the Blue Boar. It wouldn't go. And I had to be in a hotel that evening to start the next morning at 8 o'clock. And I was, of course, getting a bit worried. How the heck do I get from this service station on the UM1 in the snow to the hotel? Well, I hitched a lift. Not on a lorry, but I was towed behind a lorry. And that was one of the most frightening experiences of my life, bar none. Being towed on a short tow rope
on
in
the
Morris 8 behind this thundering great lorry up the new M1. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, somehow or other I got there. I made it on time, rather dishevelled, the next morning. Amongst all this real collection of people, 215 Squadron had been formed out of a whole hodgepodge of pilots and crews. There were guys who had flown Lancasters in the war and York transports in the Berlin airlift. There were guys off Coastal Command who had flown Shackleton. There were transport pilots, some off Comets, who used to wear white gloves for flying. very snooty they were, the ones off the Comets. And there were ones off tactical transports, Beverleys. And there were young first tourers. There were about half a dozen navigators, co-pilots, who were on their first tour. And we went to the Armstrong Whitworth factory at Baggington, near Coventry, to be told all about the systems and the operating characteristics of the Argosy. Argosy, brand new aeroplane, itself a hodgepodge. It was a political design because the RAF wanted to buy the Hercules, the C-130, from the United States, but the politicians, it was the Labour government at the time, insisted on something that was made in Coventry because they needed the votes. its wing, and Armstrong Whitworth used the wing off the Shackleton. It was a twin boomed aeroplane, and the booms were Meteor fuselages, Gloucester Meteor fuselages. The engines were the Rolls-Royce Dart, which came off the on the Vickers Viscount, and it was a real bugger's muddle. But it was a lovely aeroplane for the pilots because it had all the latest instruments. We moved on from Baggington to go to Gloucester, where we went to Smith's Instruments and learned all about the Smith's flight system.
So tell me about that.
It was, for the time, it was state of the art. It had a blind flying panel, but it also had an autopilot that could be coupled into radio beams. It had cloud and collision warning radar. It had a Doppler navigation system, which was terrific. That means that it uses the Doppler shift. You know, when you hear an ambulance coming or police car, you hear a difference in note of the siren as it goes past. That's the Doppler shift. When it's coming towards you, it's going faster than when it's going away from you.
I didn't know that.
And the radar measured that and could tell you the distance flown. It also tell you your drift. So it was a real godsend when we got out to the mountains of Borneo later on. So we paid attention at Smith's. We also paid attention in the mornings because we stayed in the joint services mess at Innsworth. I think it was joint services because there was a lovely little wren who used to come in with the tea in the morning, which was quite exciting for us youngsters. Well, it was for me anyway. We then went to Derby for the Rolls-Royce engine course.
I'm just going to ask, I should have asked the time, so you got cups of tea in bed brought in with that?
Yeah, we did. Well, we did in that mess. I can't think of it happening anywhere else but RAF Innsworth.
Just cups of tea in bed?
Cups of tea in bed,
that's
yeah.
That's not bad.
Fantastic.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, it was quite unique. We then went to Derby, where we stayed in Diggs, and that was another experience. I had stayed in Diggs before once when doing the Flying Scholarship, but never in Derby. And there were two or three of us there, and we couldn't have our dinner in the front room because the landlady's husband was laid out there waiting for the undertaker. And this didn't faze her at all, but did not faze us. Derby itself was a rough, tough place. In 1963, England, the various regions of England were very, very different. They spoke differently, couldn't understand a word that was being said, in the diggings or elsewhere. Well, we had difficulty. I remember we went 10-pin bowling. That was new. And we learned about the engines. It was very, very cold. That's the other thing, very cold and bleak. But the engines, that was very interesting because they were turboprop engines. And we'd learned about the jet engine on our Jet Promise and the piston engine on our Vastis. But this was a turboprop. And the turboprop's very different because it's basically a jet engine turbine with a prop on the front. It has advantages in efficient use of fuel, and so it's got a good range, but it can't go as fast as a jet engine because it's got a proper propeller on the front. But they were extremely reliable, and that's a good thing. Rolls-Royces. So we went, and then we went to Thorny Island, and we sat in the ground school, excuse me, navigation, meteorology. I remember learning all about something called the intertropical convergence zone, and that sounded quite interesting because we knew by this time that we were going to Singapore. we flew the simulator, which I found very difficult because with an aeroplane, you at least have the orientation of the air around you, and if it's a clear day, the horizon, all the rest of it. In the simulator, once it did have a basic view on television screens of the runway, but once you'd taken off, that was that. So I found it quite difficult to keep orientation. And I remember going round and round in circles on the downwind leg in the simulator until someone had to take over and sort me out. But in the aeroplane, it was different. Again, it was lovely weather. You took off from the aeroplane airfield and flew round the Isle of Wight, basically.
Can you, I'll just take you back slightly, just to talk me through, you mentioned the intertropical conversion zone and,
oh, yes,
and the ground school. So can you just tell me about the things that you were specifically learning there that were new at that stage?
Yes.
Before they let you loose on,
yes,
the planes?
Yes. Well, the meteorology went on a bit from the Met that we had at previously. And I suppose the whole thing was, it was transport orientated. And in V-bombers, for example, you don't worry about the weather, you get up above it. In fighters, the same thing. You go up so high that and fighters very much controlled from the ground as well. They certainly were in those days. The Cold War was going strong, and so if you got posted to a bomber or a fighter, you did what you were told by the ground controllers. That's what we were told. But in the transport, you have to get your aeroplane from A, which could be Lynham in Wiltshire, to B, which could be Aden in the Persian Gulf. So, and a lot of that will be not on airways. If you fly on airways, you also get told where to go, and you can use the radio beacons. But in a transport, you're out on your own, often across miles and miles and miles of ocean. So the meteorology becomes quite important because in the intertropical convergence zone, that's where one lot of air from the south, it's one lot of air from the north, and they rise up, causing the most horrendous storms. And if you get caught in that, you're caught in that. Of course, you can't move it. Sometimes you have to go through it, and therefore you have to learn about all the effects that lightning can have on your aeroplane. It can throw your compasses out. If the worst comes to the worst, it can set you on fire. So the Met was more immediate, I suppose.
Much more practical. Can you remember any? How do you deal with lightning destroying your instruments or putting you on fire? Can you remember any of the processes?
Yeah, in the Argosy, we were struck by lightning over the South China Sea, and it threw out 40 circuit breakers, which, I don't know how many circuit breakers we had, but the engineer was frantically resetting stuff. So you could lose you could lose everything except the pressure-driven instruments, basically. So your altimeter would continue working. Your turn and slip, I think, would turn. Would it? No, because that's got a gyroscope. So it can topple your gyroscopes. It set a Bristol freighter on fire in Borneo, I can remember. So you could. It's not stuff you want to have. Icing, that's the other thing you can get in these tremendous storms. They may be tropical storms, but you still get icing. And then there are de-icing systems, so you learn about those. But it's still, the ice gets thrown off the propellers and makes a hell of a racket and can dent your fuselage and that kind of thing. And you lose height, of course, if you can't get rid of the ice. So you learnt all about that. You learnt about now what would be the word about how to